go behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hi, and welcome to Car Stuff. I'm Scott.
I'm Ben. As always, we are joined by our super producer, Alex Odyssey Williams. And Scott, I got to say, this is one that we have talked about a lot off air for one reason or another.
Oh, sure. Yeah. This is going to be a tough one on you, I feel. And you know what, though? I'm going to try my best to avoid the forbidden topic, but it has to come up occasionally. It really does.
I just feel sometimes you just push people.
You know, I'm not one to kind of rub it in. A lot of listeners have liked to rub it in, I guess, you know, to tease you along the way,
sure,
because they know your disdain for a certain type of vehicle. It's a minivan, but not only that, a certain brand and make. And just go ahead and say it, and let's hear your. How about this? How about just a 10-second version of why that particular vehicle? You have to name it, but why does that bother you?
All right. Okay, I've got a counteroffer. I'll name it, and then at the end, if we have time, mm-hmm, I will make my case.
Okay, a mini rant.
Yes, for any of you who have not been acquainted with the Honda Odyssey, any year, any kind of modification, any sort of – you know what? We'll save it for the end.
Okay. All right. Well, I want to start off here. We've got a lot of stuff to get to. We've got listener mail. We've got all kinds of stuff.
And we've got, yeah.
I do want to say, and I hope this is the truth, mm-hmm, I don't think this is going to be a boring podcast. I think there's a lot to talk about here. As, you know, we always try to take subjects that we think we can, you know, draw on some little known facts, some interesting things and some, I guess a few facts and figures here and there, but this is more, you know, the history of and some developments, some twists and turns along the way that I didn't see coming. There's one vehicle in particular that I would doubt that you know, 5% of our audience knows of this vehicle that we're going to talk about that really led to the development of the modern minivan.
Right. You have to dig for that one.
And we'll cover that one.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think that this is going to be a boring podcast in any way. I hope so. Anyways.
Heck no. We've got twists and turns. It's an origin story. We get to the future little bit.
We're not doing reviews of any minivan models or anything like that.
No.
And, you know, we find that we're in kind of a strange position because we haven't been really defenders of minivans in the past, right? I mean, we've kind of been the opposite. Not really. I mean, a little bit along the way, we said some nice things about them, but like 10 years or so ago, I probably wouldn't have had the stance that I do today. I'm a little bit softer on the subject now, and there's some reasons.
Well, they've also not only has technology in general evolved over the first time we'd ever mentioned a minivan on this show, but also the concept from the manufacturer end has evolved, and they're much more luxurious, right?
Yeah.
But if I'm correct, I think the nicest thing I ever said about a minivan on air was along the lines of, it's your money, do what you want.
That is probably 100% accurate. You know, and I think we'll also get to, oh gosh, you catch me off guard if this is funny. All right, so I think that if you ask, you know, 10 people, let's say, or 100 people.
Sure.
Let's say 100 people.
100
people.
I think
90 of them are going to say that Chrysler invented the minivan, but I think we're going to dispel that a little bit, mm-hmm, in a way. I mean, it's sort of. It's like a half-truth, really.
Yeah, we're gonna bust a couple of myths, mm-hmm, maybe. And also, we wanted to thank everyone who wrote in because, like many of our episodes, this is a listener suggestion, a suggestion from a series of listeners.
Yeah, well, we've been doing the show for a long time. Almost, 9 years now, something like that?
Yeah.
And along the way, we've had a lot of people who want to hear about minivans. They, mm-hmm, want, because, you know, that's their vehicle of choice. You know, the family vehicle, they'd like to hear about them. So, you know, finally we're getting to it. But, you know, this year alone, in 2017, we've had a lot of requests as of late for minivan shows. So let me read just maybe two or three emails here.
Cool.
Of listener requests. The first one just is simply titled Minivan Episode ? Waiting for it. So Weston B. has written in. Weston is he says, hi guys, I'm a longtime listener. My name is Weston B. and I live in Indiana and I love your podcast. I was wondering if you guys could do an episode on minivans. Oh, and you know what? He has a part in here that we can't really do. He was asking for a top 10 of what we would recommend for the most comfortable and powerful, but we're not really a review show, but we can do a show about minivans and the way that we normally do.
Yeah, so, we can do an origin story. We can also, I think along the way, inevitably, we will compare at least some parts of this.
Yeah, sure. I guess so.
But not a full review.
Not in a professional way.
No. In a severely unprofessional.
We're going to be completely unprofessional today. All right. So the next one is just called New Listener, and this comes from S. Wirtz. S, I don't know who S is, but S says, I'm a new listener, and I must say I stumbled on a pretty good podcast. Well, that's very nice.
Well, thank you, S.
S. You guys do a great job of getting good information out and bringing listeners into thinking about things. I know I'm a little bit late, but I'm catching up quickly. He or she says, my opinion on luxury is something I was taught at a young age. Luxury is defined as anything beyond the basic needs. Some of us can afford a little more luxury than others, and some people can afford a much higher level of luxury.
Yeah.
This brings me to one of my guilty pleasures. My daily driver is a little mundane, but I have plenty of luxury items to make it a little bit more exciting. I have a pretty nice sound system, and yes, I crank it up. I have all the bells and whistles, and I have yet to find another vehicle to replace it with. Now that I've built up the suspense, I guess it's time to let you in. I drive a Chrysler Town & Country.
Mm-hmm.
It's a minivan driver. So here's a Chrysler fan.
Yeah.
I haven't yet heard a podcast on the workhorse of families that litter American highways. Litter, that's a funny word to use here. That litter American highways, city streets, and parking lots. I'm a huge fan of the minivan, and yet I have to agree, the Honda Odyssey is not for me. With that, I'll end by saying thanks for the great job you do. All right, well, thank you, S. And then here's someone who would disagree with S, who is a Chrysler fan.
Uh-huh.
This is a Honda Odyssey fan.
I think I remember this one.
That's not snarky in any way. It's not mean, but it does say, Ben, this one's for you.
I remember this.
As do a lot of these, right? Dano is the one who wrote it. I'm sorry. Yeah. I forgot to mention that. But it was actually a note about autonomous vehicle security to begin with. This is part of a larger note, but one of the paragraphs was this. I chuckle and slightly resent every time you bag on the good old Honda Odyssey. I know you don't have kids and perhaps haven't been given the opportunity to develop an appreciation for the minivan. I definitely understand your frustration with the often preoccupied drivers of minivans and being stuck in traffic behind them. But as far as minivans go, I have to say, as a Honda Odyssey owner, these things are built for battle. Battle with the wife and kids, that is. That's kind of a funny line.
Yeah.
I have owned other makes and models, and from my my experience, they're the most mechanically sound. Mm. They are not nearly as underpowered as many of the others, and their suspensions aren't quite as much like a bowl of Jell-O feeling as you get when riding in a Dodge or Chrysler. Well, this is fighting
words. Shots fired.
Yeah. Maybe we should get S. Wirtz together in the room with Dano and let them battle it out. Wouldn't that be a good idea?
Maybe we should get them together with like a demolition derby type thing.
In a minivan.
Right. We'll supply the vans.
That's not a bad idea. All right. So anyways, Dano says, I'm not sure I'll win this argument, but I wish I could change your mind to reference the Dodge Caravan as the bane of your existence. But until then, I'll continue to chuckle at your references of the Honda Odyssey. Keep up the good work.
All right. Thanks so much, guys.
We get notes like that, you know, like all the time about minivans. So we decided that we would definitely broach the topic today, and I think that one thing that we should clarify here is that we have done an episode much earlier, back in August of 2013, on Woody Station Wagons.
Right.
And Woody Station Wagons, that podcast, that kind of covered the birth of the station wagon, really. Mm-hmm. And that's critical in the development of the minivan as well, and we'll tell you the progression of that in just a moment. But can I take a sidebar here?
Oh, yeah, please.
All right, so I know we've been talking for a good 10 minutes already, least I have, about all kinds of stuff.
But well, you went on a trip recently.
I did, and that's the sidebar I wanted to take here, is that I was gone for 4 days, and this has to do with automotive stuff, I promise.
Okay.
I went to 4 different states. I went to Missouri, Nebraska, Iowa, and Kansas, and mostly hanging out in the Omaha area right around that city, across the river in Iowa. And I heard about a museum there, at least my wife heard about this museum. We decided to take a day trip to Lincoln, Nebraska, and we went to a place called the Museum of American Speed in Lincoln, Nebraska.
Yeah, I've heard of this. Now, does it measure up to the hype?
It definitely measures up to it. Yeah, I mean, I've read this in a review, you know, like I went online and read some reviews later afterwards. I didn't know anything about the museum other than I think we've had a listener or two has mentioned this place before. But they describe it as a hidden gem, and it truly is. It's kind of tucked away in an industrial complex area, like way, you know, outside of the city. But This place is amazing. If you're anywhere near there, I recommend going to it. You know, I did the same thing with the Lane Museum. That's another one that I really loved in the Nashville area. Mm-hmm. But this one is in Lincoln, Nebraska, and it has something like, I think they have about 130 cars, but they have 600 engines on display. 600 that are scattered throughout the museum all over the place. They have a Harry Miller exhibit. That's completely Harry, all about Harry Miller. We've done an episode about Harry Miller, the engine designer builder.
Right.
They have the whole timeline of his life on the wall. They have, I want to say it's 6 or 7 Harry Miller engines that are in the room on stands that you can view, and some are cutaways. They have his original drawing board there. It's mostly, mostly race cars, some street cars, a lot of hot rods. There are motorcycles. There are land speed record cars. There's current, well, cars that not quite current race cars, but retired. Probably, I'll round this number up just a little bit.
Sure.
They must have 1 billion toys. 1 billion. because the automobilia, I guess if you want to call it that, the collectibles and all that.
Yeah.
They cover floor, there's 3 floors of museum space, and they have pedal cars, they have tin toys, model, you know, like detailed model.
Do they have the die-cast stuff?
They have
like?
Die-cast, they have tether cars, they have rail cars.
Wow.
Just a little bit of everything. Some are restored, some are unrestored. You
and
know,
these
as far
are
as cars
historical.
Go.
These are displays. You can't buy them or mess around with
everything
them.
Everything is display, and it's part of this place called, and I'm going to give you a tip right now.
All right.
It's part of this place. I think the place that pays for it really or sponsors it really. I don't know how that all works out, but it's called Speedway Motors, and it's right across the parking lot, I guess, from this place.
Yeah.
It's actually called the Speedway Motors Museum of American Speed. And Speedway Motors is a race car warehouse. Like they, not race car, race car parts warehouse.
Oh, okay.
And so when you buy a museum shirt, this is the tip. At the end of my trip there, I wanted to buy a shirt in the lobby. So I asked them about it and they said, you have to go over to Speedway Motors. So I walked over there and it's a parts counter with this enormous warehouse. I mean, the kind where, you know, they ride on electric carts to get the parts, but it's a huge place. All race car parts and street car parts and hot rod parts and all that. It's really a cool place. You only get to see the counter though, but it's enormous.
I imagine.
So I order a shirt over there and it takes them, you know, 25 minutes to get the shirt because that's probably in the back corner.
Because they had to get a guy on the cart.
He did. Yeah. He took a cart back to the corner to buy one shirt. It's crazy. So anyways, totally worth it. But when he's handing me back the shirt and my receipt, the shirt was only like $20, right? So he hands it back and he says, have you gone to the museum yet? I said, yeah, I just came from there. They sent me over here to get the shirt. And he said, this receipt would have been good for a free admission.
So go buy the shirt first.
So buy the shirt first. You get a free admission into the museum, which is $15. So I spent $15 to get into the museum, $21 on the shirt, when I could have just spent $21 on the shirt and got both things, you know, for that price.
But if it doesn't have an expiration date and you just keep the receipt, you know, the thing is, though,
all right.
Did you keep the receipt?
Well, I did keep the receipt. I still have the receipt because I haven't unpacked yet.
Okay.
I mean, I'm back that recently, but, it goes to a good cause. I mean, it's all to keep the museum going. So, you know, I thought, well, I kind of got taken on that, but then I thought, well, it's actually for a great cause. It's, you look at it as a, like a donation to the museum.
Right.
If you want to look at it that way.
Sure.
You gotta
remember though, Scott, a lot of those receipts, even if they don't have expiration dates, the ink that they're printed with, will disappear over time.
Oh, that's true. Yeah. Let's leave it out in the car on the dash for a while and see what happens.
I bet you could have. You know what? Somebody lives in the Omaha area listening to this show. Mm-hmm. Depending on – now, this is very cheap, even for me.
What, raffle it off?
For just the price of a postage stamp. You
no,
too.
No, I'm not gonna do that because honestly, I mean
– It does support
the
good
museum
cause.
Is absolutely incredible. Mm. And if you can get there, go. But it's one of those places where when I walked in, I immediately felt overwhelmed as well because there's so much to look at. There's no way. I went through and took a lot of photographs of the car, then the placard, and then I moved on. And I know that's not a great way to go through a museum, but you get to a point where you're on, you know, the second, third floors and you just are running out of time. The place is going to close down.
So you're running and gunning.
It was kind of like that. Yeah, it's an incredible experience. So if anybody's in that area, I haven't had a museum experience like that since I went to the Lane Museum, and that says a lot.
That does. Hey, quick question though, unrelated.
Mm-hmm.
Did you guys get any steaks while you were out there? We were talking about this earlier.
Oh, boy. Okay, so Omaha Steaks, right?
Yeah.
That's supposed to be the big thing?
That's supposed to be like a real big thing.
Well, let me tell you something. I won't reveal where I was staying.
Okay.
But I went to a steakhouse that in the facility that I was staying.
Sure.
that claimed to have Omaha steaks, and they did. Uh-huh. You know, of course, it's right there.
Yeah.
I was disappointed.
What?
I know. I know. I was blown away, but I was expected the most perfect steak ever. And,
right.
And nope.
In
nope.
All, in like 49 other states, whenever Omaha, Nebraska comes up, us carnivores are all about the, look, hearing about these steaks.
Salivating, right? Like,
right.
You think this is going to be fantastic. And I've actually had Omaha steaks that have been, you know, like freeze dried and shipped and then grilled somewhere else. And they're fine. I think it was all in the preparation. I think whoever did this, whoever was mm-hmm. on the grill mm-hmm. didn't do the best job because, I mean, it just wasn't good. It wasn't good. I can't give it a good rating.
Well, you can't judge the entire industry by the one steak.
No, absolutely. And you know what? I'm kind of a defender, I guess. I'm a defender of Omaha steaks, I guess. In that I've had them in the past and they've been excellent.
Yeah.
This particular one, not good. Not good. $62 and it was not good.
$62.
Yep. Yep. Steakhouse prices, man.
I wonder if you could have given them that Speedway receipt.
Yeah,
for a couple bucks.
I know.
Off.
You know what? It's an expensive weekend. Let's move on.
Okay. Yeah. and also for the record, I have never been to Nebraska, so far as I'm aware.
Oh, you know what? All four states, I have nothing bad to say. It was great.
Yeah.
Really, really cool.
First time in Iowa too, right?
First time in three of those four states. Yeah.
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 What was the third one? What was your first time?
Kansas.
Yeah. Kansas.
Kansas. Nebraska. Mm-hmm. I had been to Missouri before.
Yeah.
And Iowa.
All right. Well, I feel like I have to go now.
Well, I mean, I guess you check it off on the list, right?
I got a map at home. To the museum.
You know, I like when you get the map at home and you want to check off all the states you've been in.
Yeah. I have
one
of
those. Took care of four.
Yeah.
Right there.
I have a world map and, you know, it gets to the point where I feel like before I die, I have a lot of places to go. Otherwise, this map is going to look like, on a global scale, I was just hanging out in my apartment. I started even planning trips by how far away they are from the other pins, so I look like a more interesting person.
Yeah.
Nebraska's far enough away.
Good plan. Good plan.
Yeah, nothing shallow.
Well,
I
won't say anything bad about any of those four states. They were great to visit.
Yeah, I almost lived in Iowa for a while.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, yeah. I didn't. Great story, huh? I was going to go to grad school in Iowa.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh.
And then I didn't.
Well, now I feel silly for saying that.
You should not feel silly if you assume that on November 2nd, 1983, the world's first minivan rolled off the Chrysler assembly line.
Nice segue.
Thank you.
Yeah. So, all right. So Chrysler, I mean, so we'll get to this, this more detail later.
Yeah, this is the fake opener. This is the opener everybody thinks of. Right?
Yeah. That's right. This is the 1983 as an 84 model year.
Right. Right.
The Plymouth Voyager Dodge Caravan. And of course, Plymouth, you know, went away, but this is the one that everybody thinks of as the modern minivan, the one that everybody can probably picture in their mind's eye, you know, as the, pretty boxy, has typically, if you're thinking of these, they're going to have the, you know, the fake, you know, vinyl wood on the side, mm-hmm. you know, that kind of thing, mm-hmm. the carryover from the station wagons. That makes sense.
And that all important sliding door.
Yeah. The sliding door, which, that was really important. I mean, it's kind of, again, minivan, the whole term, I mean, this is a brand new segment, really, in 1984 because we're coming down from full-size vans, which a lot of people had. A lot of families had those. And we'll get to the station wagons as well, I promise. But
yeah.
The full-size van was something that a lot of families relied on as having, you know, high seating capacity, high cargo carrying capacity as well. You know, even more so than a lot of the station wagons that were out there. You could carry, you know, lots of passengers, you know, up to a dozen passengers or, you know, nine and a lot of luggage or something like that. But
yeah,
there were some problems with the full size van as well.
Right. Two of the biggest being the terrible, horrific fuel economy.
Yeah.
Especially if we're considering the time in which the time that preceded the minivan era, you know, full size vans during like a gas crisis. Mm-hmm. That's not a good look. And then also, the fact that, to allude to, Dano's earlier statement, full-size vans just have terrible handling.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah, they're a tall vehicle and a little sloppy because, you know, they've got a lot of suspension travel because they're carrying heavy loads, lots of people, lots of cargo. So there are other problems that we will get to when we get to, when we start talking about another interesting vehicle that I don't know if I want to give it away just yet. I don't think we should. Maybe we should talk about, like, kind of where minivans came from, really.
Sure,
I mean,
yeah.
We hinted that, you know, they're a small van, of course. Everybody knows that, but
some sort of, dare I say, miniature van.
Yes. Yeah, you're right on, spot on, Ben.
Thanks, man. I went to college and stuff.
Nearly in Iowa. yeah. All right. So this all goes back to, and I guess maybe we probably covered some of this in the Woody Station Wagons episode. I didn't listen to it beforehand, but I think we did.
Uh-huh.
It goes back to train travel, of all things.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and the way we get to it is there's train travel, and a lot of people are using, you know, the depot there in town, or depot, however you like to say it. I'd say depot in this case. And with that came something called depot hacks. And essentially these were taxis. These are people that were shuttling people and, you know, luggage to and from the train depot. It makes perfect sense, right?
Sure.
So this goes back to, like, you know, the Model T days, the early days of the automobile. And again, high seating capacity, high cargo carrying capacity. And a lot of times these depot hacks, if you can, you know, do a Google search for that word, those two words, you'll find that these are open carriers, really.
Right.
A lot of them don't even have windows.
Well, yeah, this is still in the day of custom carriage work.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of these things were the engine and the chassis, and then having that shipped somewhere, and then having somebody probably local or regional construct out of wood and mainly out of wood, a carapace, and making the rest of the coach.
Good word.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you. I almost went to school in Iowa, so.
It's fancy.
Thanks, man.
Yeah.
I'm going to regret that joke. But another important thing to say here is this may sound familiar to some of us out here, because it's essentially fulfilling the role of a hotel shuttle or an airport shuttle today. So, you know,
which is often a full-size van.
Right. Still,
yeah.
So the depot or the depot, right, is probably going to be not right downtown, you know?
No, exactly.
Or at least hotels usually don't want to be set up right next to a train station. So we need that kind of short distance transit.
Yeah, that's right. And even if it's in a small town, you still need to carry, you know, all of that luggage that, you know, it's funny, if you think back to, you know, the excess luggage that people carried back in that time.
Oh,
like
yeah.
In the early 1900s. I mean, it was more, I guess, what would be a comparison? Like camping versus glamping, you know, like maybe
there
that,
we go.
Like when you're traveling versus like when you're like taking a luxurious trip on an ocean liner or something, you have to get to there. So you take all this luggage. I mean, you might have 10 pieces of luggage for a family that, you know, three.
Right.
That are enormous. These big old wooden, wooden and leather cases that had these big straps on them with all the stickers from where they've been.
And people had like just boxes for their hats.
Yeah, well, exactly.
Which still blows my mind, but I guess I've never owned a nice hat.
A hat box, yeah, sure. Well, anyways, these are the wooden body cars that were made by, you know, cabinet makers, coffin makers, you know, the people that created things out of wood during the day. So the depot hacks, the taxis then led to enclosed wagons, and that was what we think of as a station wagon. Now, station, of course, train station wagon, right?
Think about it.
But it wasn't just like going to the station, but that's kind of where that word came from.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially, station wagons and depot hacks were sort of the same thing, you know, ballpark. They were enclosed. Finally, they had, you know, windows. They had, you know, better seats, you know, maybe soft seats instead of, you know, the wooden benches that they had before.
Sure.
The enclosed seating thing was big, because prior to that, it was just all wide open, and they had maybe some roll down curtains that were.
You're kind of riding in a pickup bed.
Yeah. Like, they're canvas or something, to cover you from the elements. But, the station wagons led to, and I'm just really blanket paraphrasing here, but the station wagons then led to minivans. Now, the minivans, as we talked about in the 1980s or mid-1980s, so station wagons were around for a long, long time. I mean, from the 1920s, 1930s.
Easily.
Up until the mid-1980s.
Mm-hmm.
And then the, what I guess we'll call them, I don't know if I'm giving something away here. I'll say a word here that will come up later. minivans were garageable vans.
Ah, okay.
That's a garageable. That's garageable. A term. That's an actual term.
Yes.
Garageable vans. And we'll talk about that later.
Sure.
But minivans then now, recently, I guess, have given over to crossovers, which are kind of a, like between the SUV size mm-hmm. and station wagon size.
Right.
And I do want to point out here something. Now, we've talked about Woody wagons and how important they mm-hmm. were. And, you know, this is going right back to the Woody days, but there was a time when station wagons were extremely prestigious. And believe it or not, I mean, it wasn't always just the grocery getter family wagon.
Right.
And there were scaled back versions that were that, even in the time frame that I'm talking about. But there were also wagons that catered to the wealthy, catered to mm-hmm. the people that wanted to take the, you know, the cross-country tours.
Like a chauffeured station wagon. Yeah. I know it sounds weird now, but that was a thing.
Ask Elvis. Yeah, ask Elvis. He had a Cadillac station wagon. Anyways, the 1940s, just for an example, and this is one that I got from a site called Allpar, which is a Chrysler Dodge site, Jeep, I think, as well. The 1941 Chrysler Town and Country station wagon was the most expensive station wagon for that year of its kind. And I thought they said it was the most expensive car in the lineup, but I don't know if that's 100% Ooh. True for Chrysler, because they had some pretty luxurious cars back in that day. But regardless, it was the most expensive station wagon in 1941. And so, you know, it makes sense. Most luxurious, most expensive. It was ballpark price around $5,000, which if you were to take that into today's dollar amount,
yeah,
right around $83,000 if you were to buy one today, you know, at that price at $5,000. Well, wow. Did I say that right? I always get that mixed up.
Mm-hmm.
$5,000 in 1941, that was a lot of cash, a lot of cabbage, a lot of cheese.
A lot of scratch.
Yeah, exactly. So, again, the prestige carried for a long, long time, but then they kind of lost favor.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely mm-hmm. true. And it may be, in some ways, it may be a trend that we've seen in other markets where, as it becomes more easily available to, you know, your average, like, day-to-day, middle-income, John and Jane American, then a little bit of the cachet begins to wear away.
Well, but by no means are they gone either, though. We talked about this off air, right?
Yeah,
A lot of the European marks still make them.
And you raised a great point, too, about the type of marks that make them.
Yeah, luxury.
Right.
Luxury. So it's, you know, BMW, it's Mercedes, mm-hmm. it's, Audi makes yeah. one as well. Volvo, I guess. I don't know if Volvo's not really luxury. Let's call it a safety wagon.
Safety wagon?
Yeah, maybe we'll call it a safety
That's great.
Wagon, but,
That's great.
It probably has a lot of luxury features. And, let's see, who do we say? BMW, Mercedes, mm-hmm. I think Cadillac.
Yeah,
makes sense as well. So they're still being made in the United States as well.
It's just you see them more in Europe.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. And I'm not going to be able to hit every brand that has a station wagon still, but there are even still some, I guess you call them economy or, more standard, I guess, brands that,
sure.
Not luxury brands that mm-hmm. still offer a station wagon as a possibility.
So there you have it, folks. The general lay of the land. Scott, I think we've done a pretty solid job of just sort of tracing the big steps.
Mm-hmm.
And you can already see how the story of minivans does not by any means start in the early 1980s. In fact, we are going to let you in on some insider evolution of minivans that you might not hear in all the retrospectives that came out in 2013, 2014, and we'll get to them right after this word from our sponsor. And we have returned. So before the break, we talked about the basic evolution starting in the days of railroads, right,
mm-hmm.
Into station wagons and how station wagons became a luxurious thing and then more of a normal everyday thing. And ultimately, we said, the next big step was the minivan. But that's not entirely the case. That's the abridged version. You know, that's what we would say if someone said, tell us about where minivans came from in 3 minutes.
Yeah.
The real story is, I think, much more interesting and has a lot of twists and turns. And one of the coolest ones is something that we personally saw at a museum here in Atlanta. You see, way before 1983 was even a thing that people thought about outside of science fiction novels, way back in 1936, there was a very unique and strange vehicle called the Stout Scarab.
Yeah, someone very forward-thinking came up with the Stout Scarab, right? Because that's one that we covered in – yeah, it was the High Museum of Art here in Atlanta, mm-hmm. right? And we've got a video online if you want to watch it about the Stout Scarab. And again, 1936, that's 47 years prior mm-hmm. to what we think of as the minivan. But if you look at the Stout Scarab – that has a lot of features that are included in modern minivans, or at least in minivans to begin with. Mm-hmm. Had things like removable tables and second row seating. The front seats, I think the first row seats, I think turned around to face the second row.
The second row seats could turn 180 degrees.
Oh, gotcha.
To where you put the table up so you could still have someone driving while everybody else was in the back playing Uno or something.
Yeah, you could play games or whatever. Mm-hmm. I mean, in a lot of ways, you know, full-size vans had a lot of the same features, I suppose, but on a much larger scale. So, you know, the Stout Scarab is closer to minivan size than anything else of its I don't know if that's the right way to say it, maybe. There were other vehicles that were bigger, but this one had minivan-esque features, maybe,
like
inside.
Maybe we would call it minivan DNA.
Yeah, that's probably a better
way
to say it.
Is that all right?
Yeah, that's good. That's fine.
This is why you will sometimes hear people say that the Stout Scarab is the world's first production minivan. But as we know, it is difficult to rate something as the first without several caveats.
All right. Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, whenever anybody says, like, this is really the first one, it's not the first one that was called a minivan. They didn't call it that.
Right.
So I guess Chrysler has the lock on that, really, because they called it a minivan in 1984. But going back to 1936, there sure were a lot of features that made it, a lot like a minivan. Exactly. Okay, so there's another company called DKW. And DKW – actually, you know what? We should talk about DKW for just a second.
Yeah.
DKW was one of the four companies that joined together to form Auto Union, which was I think it's Audi, Horsch, DKW, and Wanderer. That's the interlock four rings on the Audi symbol today. And so DKW had a vehicle called the Schnellaster. Schnellaster, maybe? I don't know how to
say Schnellaster.
I guess Schnellaster, sure. But that was manufactured from 1949 until 1962. Mm-hmm. And it was one of the first few vehicles, I guess, that was a production vehicle, to feature the characteristics of modern minivans, because I think the Stout Scarab, they only made like 10 of those. So it's kind of a one-off example, I guess, or a 10-off maybe, example. But you'll see them in museums and, you know, I guess maybe, you know, there's the odd owner that, you know, might drive it around to shows, you know, the Concours shows or something. But
yeah, but that goes into, and I don't want to derail us too far, but that goes into the old problem of how to best define what makes a production threshold for a car.
Yeah, I guess
so. You know what I mean?
A production run of 10 is still a production run.
Yeah.
Hand-built. But see, I would say that DKW probably had more of a an assembly line production going from, you know, 1949 to 62. That's a long that's a long run, more than, you know, just throwing together, but, you know, like putting together 10 cars is I don't want to say easier, but it's easier than running, you know, a factory, than running a factory for 13 years. So I guess you could look at it that way. And at the same time as DKW is doing that with the Schnellaster, I hope I'm getting that right. In 1950, the Volkswagen Type 2, was like a bus adaptation to the Volkswagen Beetle. Mm-hmm. So that's when the microbus really came out. And a lot of people think of the microbus as maybe being the first minivan. It's not exactly right. I mean, it has the same features that we're talking about. You know, it has this is where we get into the gray area, I guess, with all these vehicles. And there's more than this, too. But the gray area is that this is we're going to talk about this in a moment, a one-box design, whereas current modern minivans have a two-box design. And we'll talk about box design in just a moment. But I need to get another example out, because I promise we'll get to box design. wasn't there another one? There was a
Let's see. There's so we mentioned DKW.
Yeah, yep. We mentioned that. And the one that I'm
type two.
The one that I'm thinking about is the Fiat 600 Multipla.
Yeah.
And if you have never seen a 1956 Multipla, check it out. But I mean, I think you'll find that it's shaped a lot like the Scarab in that it has rounded corners front and back. And that's an interesting looking vehicle. Has a lot of again the same type of thing. The high passenger capacity, high cargo capacity. It's a small vehicle because it's a Fiat. But it has that shape. It has those features. So a lot of people say that maybe that's the first minivan. So there's a lot of contenders here. There's another one. There's the Lloyd LT. Now, Lloyd is a German manufacturer, and they built the LT500 between 1953 and 1957. And it's a six-seater minivan version. And this one, to me, Ben, this Lloyd LT probably has the most modern look to it as far as, the minivan contenders for the first ever.
That reminds me. Speaking of longer back ends, I can't believe we got this far. It's
Where are you going with this, Ben?
More like a full size van than a minivan.
Yeah,
Buckminster Fuller's Dymaxion.
Yeah, well, that's big,
That's big. But it's got like
the shape of the Scarab, the shape of this Fiat, this Fiat 600 Multipla.
Mm-hmm.
It reminds me of the Dymaxion. You're right,
and the Dymaxion is apparently a nightmare to drive.
I can imagine. I mean, this is going back to the Lane Museum. They have a full-size replica of a Dymaxion there.
Can you go inside?
I don't think you can go inside, but you can sure peek inside of it. At the Lane Museum, I don't think – I'm trying to recall now. It's been a couple of years, but I don't think they have the rope stanchions around all the vehicles. You can really get right in and lean.
That's cool.
You can lean right up to and right in, but
yeah.
Don't touch them. You know, that's the rule.
Yeah. Well, don't try to drive even if you have an opportunity, apparently – the Dymaxion is a real pill to drive.
pill, I like that term.
Yeah, I'm bringing it back. there's some serious steering issues with it, which is fine. You can be a genius at one thing and still not be great at designing cars.
Of course. And it was an intriguing design, I remember. It was different. It was a lot like a small RV, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But just fascinating car. If you don't know much about it, take a look at it. Mm-hmm. And I think we should probably at this point – so anyways, we've got – several early minivan contenders, ones that claim to have been the first, right?
Right. And if you look at them at the first glance, they can seem to be pretty varied. And in many ways they are. However, they are all – this is the crucial part here. They all come out in a relatively small span of time, right, compared to each other. And they're all attempting to address the same concerns, which is – family-friendly transport.
Sure.
Ultimately. Or like small group transport, because beforehand we would have larger people movers. I'm just going to use that phrase because it's vague enough to encompass everything.
Yeah.
And then we would have commercial transit. So this is essentially a way for a private individual to, under their own power, transport, many more people than would be typical in a vehicle at the time.
The whole family plus all of their crap.
Mm-hmm. Bring your grandma too.
All their stuff, I should say. Mm-hmm.
And their boxes for their hats.
Yeah, their hat boxes, their hunting gear or whatever they're bringing, right?
Picnic boxes.
Yeah, those great big wicker picnic baskets that they have, yeah.
And so the auto manufacturers do not exist in a vacuum. So the market is teaching these manufacturers what they want. And one of the other big things – I can't believe I almost forgot to mention this is one of the biggest things.
What's that?
It's the efficient use of space and how best to organize and allocate space in so that you can have the smallest possible footprint with the largest possible amount of room.
Well, they had the right idea going all the way back to the depot hacks. I mean, really, they did. But the depot hacks were what we'll call a two-box design. Now, I hinted earlier that we're going to talk about this.
Oh, yeah.
So we'll talk about box design. And I hope this doesn't make your eyes glaze over, but we talked about it with the Mini, I think. Mini was a two-box design as well.
Uh-huh.
But you can kind of picture this, I think, if you want to, like, think of it this way. There's one-box, two-box, and three-box designs. And I've got examples of each one. And just me describing this type of vehicle, you should understand what I'm talking about. But we'll clarify in just a moment.
Okay.
So the VW microbus, that's an example of a one-box design. That's relatively flat front end, flat back end. There's just the cabin area, and that's about it, right?
Yeah.
Still has all the pillars, but it's just a box design. A lot of people can picture that in their, mm-hmm. their mind's eye. The Lincoln Town Car is a three-box design. It has a hood, an area for the engine.
Right.
It has a cabin, and then it also has a trunk area. That's
okay.
That's a small box, a big box in the middle, and a small box at the end.
I see.
Three-box okay. design.
That makes sense.
And then – you know, the minivans, the modern minivans, have a two-box design. So, like the Toyota Sienna minivan, I guess, has a smaller box in the front where the hood is covered because it's kind of an aerodynamic design. It's not flat.
Right.
Like the microbus. It has more of more like a small truck front end, maybe, mm-hmm. if you want to put it that way.
And but then, it does have a discernible hood.
It does. It has a hood and an engine compartment, you know, so that's one box. And then the second box would be the long back end that's a cabin area for, you know, people and cargo. And then vans, I guess, are, you know, they fall under one or two box designs as well. Depends on the front end, I suppose. So you can kind of understand, but modern minivans typically have a two box design. Again, it's like the hood area and then the cabin and cargo area. Right. Sedans typically fall under three-box styling, and, you know, this has to go with the number of pillars and all that as well. Wagons, they often are actually almost always are two-box designs because they end flat at the back. And then, you know, it's like station wagons, I mean. And then hatchbacks are actually a two-box design as well for the engine compartment.
Right.
And then the cabin and cargo area. The hatch kind of falls under the same box.
Because it's still the same open space.
Exactly, yeah, because you're sitting kind of under the hatch, I guess, if you're in the back seat or even in the front sometimes. Hatchbacks typically fall under two-box designs. So right. you understand what we're talking about when we get to that, because looking back at, like, the Lloyd, that's a two-box design. If you look at the VW microbus, that's a one-box design. A lot of the early ones were one-box designs, and that's not counterintuitive, I guess, you know, given the way that trucks were designed then. They had very flat front ends. They didn't really care about aerodynamics and fuel economy and all that at the time. They were more concerned with, you know, being able to carry a lot of people and carry a lot of stuff. And it didn't matter how much fuel it cost, you know, to get them to the depot or, you know, back to the hotel or whatever. So just so we're clear on, you know, the box designs and the idea behind the styling of all this and, you know, how it ties into, you know, the modern minivan.
Right. And just to be clear, the size of the box doesn't matter in this concept.
No.
So that's why, for instance, you see a Bluebird school bus with a flat face. That's a one box design.
Yeah, exactly.
It's just one long rectangular box.
But then they upped it, and I think, and then they make a two box design
eventually. Yeah, two boxes.
Eventually, yeah. Well, I mean, everybody kind of went that way. But yeah, right. they're those old, you're exactly right. Those old giant buses had those big flat front ends.
Yeah.
Not the most aerodynamic things in the world. I mean, I guess Winnebagos fall under one box design as well, if you want to count it that way.
It's, it's just about, it's about getting all the people there eventually.
So, okay, so we're progressing here, and, you know,
yeah.
I think that you had talked earlier that we would get into the era of the 1970s, and I think maybe before we do that, we should take a word from our sponsor.
All right, and we're back. We took a break, had some snacks.
Had a sandwich.
Yeah, hope you guys had a good sponsor break too.
It's a fast sandwich.
It was fast. It was a fast sandwich.
Very fast.
We want to keep it moving.
Yeah.
Scott, you had alluded to the 1970s, and that's because we're entering into hey man, I don't know if we've ever talked about this, even off air. Are you a fan of alternative historical fiction?
Oh, sure, yeah.
Like what if
something
had gone different?
Yeah, sure. Like you know, the whole Cuban Missile Crisis thing, like
right.
You know, what if it had been cloudy that
right,
day, that
right.
kind of thing.
Or what if Elvis had a different hit? I don't know.
Yeah, there's all kinds of stuff like that.
Yeah.
But the what ifs are interesting.
So we're entering a what if moment in the development and the rise of what would later be popularly called the minivan.
Mm-hmm.
So we know that, like, if we are fictional auto manufacturers, right,
mm-hmm.
in late 60s, early 70s, we know that people like being able to travel in one vehicle with mm-hmm. their whole family.
Yeah.
We know that they don't particularly care how fast it is. They're willing to sacrifice some performance, mm-hmm. high-end performance for family. We realize that previous iterations of vehicles have proven there are some definite rules or like rules of thumb for good interior use of space in the vehicle. Mm-hmm. We also know, and again, we spend all our days doing this as fictional car manufacturers, we also know that the average American household probably doesn't want a bus. They probably don't want a van,
yeah,
a full-size van. In fact, they might not have a place to put it.
Yeah, most don't have a place to put a full-size van because they don't fit into a standard garage.
They're not garageable.
That's right. So there's the term, right? Garageable. And we'll get to that term in the story, I promise you, because we haven't yet gotten to the 1980s. Something very, very interesting happened in the early 1970s. In fact, I would say right around 1970, maybe 1971, 72, somewhere there.
Yeah.
This is something that I'll tell you. I'll be upfront with you about this, Ben. I think this is the most probably the most important step, but to me also the most interesting part of the story. This whole story, this entire episode, is what's happening right now in 1972 with Ford Motor Company. Mm-hmm. And the truth is that Chrysler and Ford each had started working on minivans in the early part of the 1970s, but neither one of them made any progress until this just by chance combination came up of leaders and technology.
Yeah.
So here's where we're going with this. In 1973, they developed it in 1972, but in 1973, Ford had a product called a concept vehicle called the Ford Carousel. And spelled just as you would think, Carousel. I think there's an alternate spelling of that as well. But mm-hmm. If you look up Ford Carousel 1973, you'll find a photo of this. And I'm going to show Ben a photo of this, along with a 1984 Plymouth Voyager, which was the so-called first minivan from Chrysler.
Right, right.
I'm going to show you them. They're side by side in this photo.
They are so very, very similar.
Very much alike, and there's a very good reason for that. Now, that's two separate companies, right? Ford and Chrysler. You would think that there would be some kind of variation, but they are really, really close in proximity, you know, the way that they look. Now, the Carousel was, of course, a Ford code name. You know, they do that a lot to keep things kind of secret on the down low, I guess, right? So, you know, like here's an example. Like the 5-liter Mustang GT engine is called the Coyote engine. That stuck with it. Mm-hmm. A lot of people still call it that in public.
Yeah, because it sounds cool.
Early on in development, it was the Coyote engine. Mm-hmm. So that's, you know, the internal stuff. And no one really knows what you're talking about outside of the company. But the Ford Carousel, and we'll just kind of go through this history of this carousel because this does play right into the Chrysler minivan. It was developed in 1972 and I think released, I guess, or shown in 1973, but they never produced this vehicle outright. This vehicle actually explored a lot of the different concepts that the first American market minivans now have in production or did have in production in the early 1980s. Now, this was called a garageable van, as you said earlier, Ben, a garageable van because it was designed to fit in a standard American garage, which was just slightly over 7 feet tall.
Yeah.
Because the standard of the full size vans were a full 7 feet tall. And, you know, that just left, you know, inches of space in between, you know, the top of the van and, you know, the garage door itself. And that kind of depended on where if the springs allowed it to come all the way up or not, you know, so there's some, you know, variation there.
Sure.
They were shooting for something that was a lot lower, but was still the cargo carrying capacity and the people carrying capacity of a full size van. And they just didn't have anything like that at the time. So Ford, was working on something that they had another code name. It was called Nantucket. And Nantucket was, supposed to be like a redesign of the Ford Econoline and the Club Wagon, which were the full size vans.
Which might, like today, you might think of them, Ford E-Series, right?
Yeah.
Church vans.
Exactly. Yeah. The church, the ones that carry 12 or 15 people or whatever. Yeah. They're big, these big vans. But the idea for the Nantucket or codename Nantucket was to increase the front seat interior room. And a drawback of that design was that its increased height for the people, who wanted one as like a daily driver. You know, people who wanted these, you know, to carry their, you know, 5 or 6 kids or whatever they had at the time. Or maybe, you know, they had needs to carry a baseball team or a football team or something like that. So
the problem was it was almost 7 feet tall, which means your clearance is going to be what?
Yeah. If at all, you're going to have any clearance.
Like
right?
a matter of inches.
Yeah, that's right. So, there's a problem there, right? So the idea was they're going to create this garageable van, which kind of fell below the size of that. So in 1972, the Ford president at the time, who you got to remember, was Lee Iacocca. That's really important yeah. to the story. Lee Iacocca approved the expansion of the Nantucket project to include a third vehicle alongside the Econoline and the Club Wagon, which was codenamed Carousel. So here we go with the Carousel. Mm-hmm. And this new variant was, of course, said to be a garageable van. That's what he wanted. That was the whole intent of this thing. And so, you know, the buyers of full-size station wagons and passenger vans would find interest in this because it was something in between. It was right between mm-hmm. that full-size van and the station wagons that they were offering at the time.
You could almost say it crossed over.
It was a crossover, but there wasn't a term, but it was a small van. So they,
right.
so, and they didn't coin the term yet. They didn't call it a minivan yet,
but
it was a minivan. It was a mini version of the Econoline and the Club Wagon that Ford already had. They just didn't know to call it yet, you know, that at the time. So we're talking about somewhere in between the size of like the Ford LTD Country Squire and, of course, the Club Wagon. And, of course, had all the cargo carrying capacity.
Interesting bit of trivia, if I may.
Okay.
It was designed by Dick Nesbitt, right?
Mm-hmm.
The same guy who went on to design the Ford Mustang II.
Hmm, okay.
He's got a lot of variation in his designs.
Yeah, you know, Iacocca was critical in a lot of this stuff as well. I mean, he was with the Mustang, the Pinto, Ford Escort, for Ford, of course. But then moving on later, of course, as you know, well, you know what? We're jumping ahead of ourselves here.
Going back,
we should say that the Carousel actually had a lot of support. Internally with the Ford Motor Company.
Yeah, people liked it.
Yeah, Henry Ford II, Henry Ford II was running the company at the time. He would have been the oldest son of Edsel Ford and the oldest grandson of Henry Ford. That's Henry Ford II. He liked it as well. So, you know, that's the step in the right direction,
from
I guess.
From the top.
Yeah, you would think that the Carousel would go on to production, you know, because, you know, it's got the approval of the top execs, right?
Yeah, but then, of course, we have to remember the time in which this was developed.
Yeah. So there was opposition.
There was opposition, because some of the other Ford executives were, I'm sure, very diplomatic when they're talking to the owner of the company. But their fear, which I think was valid, was that this might threaten to cannibalize sales
of
other vehicles.
Of the ones we just talked about.
Right.
Of the station wagon. Yeah, the LTD Country Squire. And, of course, there's another one called the Mercury Colony Park. I think that's another station wagon.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, I don't know about the van. I don't know if it would cannibalize the van sales at all or not, but maybe. But as you said, Ben, you had hinted that it was, a victim of timing as well. This
yes.
is why it didn't go into production.
Right. The energy crisis, this is why it's almost what-if-ery on our parts. What if it had gone into production? It got very close, but the 1973 energy crisis and the subsequent recession in the mid-70s made the company cut back. Ford had to cut back on development of entirely new vehicles. And one of their policies at the time to cut cost was to say, unless a vehicle is replacing an already successful line, we're not going to try to go out and make a new market.
Oh, I see.
You know what I mean?
And like, since the Carousel was an all-new vehicle,
right.
It got the axe, right?
Yeah. There were a lot of axes in the 70s,
yeah.
It turns out.
Yeah, unfortunately, right? So 1973 comes and goes, and the Carousel really goes nowhere. There's nothing left to it. But again, take a look at a photo of a Carousel, and I think you'll see exactly where I'm going with this. But just 5 years later, in 1978, Lee Iacocca was fired from Ford Motor Company, and just months later, the director of product planning, his name was Hal Spurlick. He also left the company, and after that, both of those executives were hired in similar roles at the Chrysler Corporation. So, you know, that's the era when Chrysler was really
right.
down in the dumps. I mean, they were bankrupt. They were going to go under, the whole company.
Yeah.
Everything. And so I think a lot of people recall that, you know, there were some bold statements made by Lee Iacocca, and they borrowed some money, and they actually paid all that money back on,
yeah.
you know, ahead of time.
Mm-hmm.
There's a great story there. We probably should cover it at some point in a podcast.
That's a good idea.
But yeah. I hadn't really even thought of that, but the resurrection of the Chrysler brand,
yeah.
because it did come back. But the timing is so interesting. So in 1978, Iacocca and this other guy, Hal Spurlick, go over to Chrysler Corporation.
Mm-hmm.
And now this is interesting because this is right around the time when the K car came about, and the K car is said to have saved Chrysler Corporation. It was the economy car that was a platform that they could build on.
They had a compact sedan.
They had the Reliant K. They had the Omni. They had all kind. They had the LeBaron, I think, was on that platform as well. There were a lot of different cars that were on that platform, and platform engineering became a thing where you had a same like the basic chassis and engines even, and you just put a different body on it.
Tremendous savings.
Body interior. Yeah, huge savings. And, you know, again, there's another possible podcast right there. So if you go just a few years forward, I mean, we're not really long into the K car platform of vehicles when, the 1984 Plymouth Voyager and Dodge Caravan are revealed to the public.
Right.
Yeah. In 1983, I believe, right?
Yeah.
But I believe it was the Plymouth Voyager was the first one that was revealed and maybe along with the Dodge Caravan. But anyways, they were built on the
K car chassis.
They were built on the K car chassis, the Reliant K car. But it didn't actually share the platform. That's the tricky part of this thing.
Right.
The minivans weren't the K car platform, but it was based on the Reliant K. Maybe that's the better way to say it. It's based on the Reliant K.
Yeah.
And they were built on the Windsor assembly line over in, Windsor, Ontario, Canada. And, this is interesting too. I found this out, and I hadn't thought of this. The Plymouth Voyager and the Dodge Caravan actually pioneered Chrysler's cab forward design 10 years before the LH line of products. Now, that's when they started calling it the cab forward design.
Yeah.
But if you look at a minivan, the wheels are pushed way out to the corners. And that was the idea behind the cab forward design that came about in the 1990s, maybe early 1990 up through the early 2000s.
When they started using that in like their literature.
Well, like, the Chrysler Concord, the Intrepid, Eagle Vision, back when Eagle was a brand. So I'm trying to think of the other ones. I can't right now. Oh, maybe the 300M. I think that was another one. But anyways, it was a revolutionary step when they actually said, here's our newest minivan. And people loved it. Right away, people gravitated to this. I think in the first year, they sold something like 22,000 of these things.
Going gangbusters, in many ways, I think it was the first ray of light for Chrysler, when people start buying these things like hotcakes.
But again, I'm going to show you this photo again.
It's very close.
Okay, so imagining that the guy that was in charge of this program, the Ford, the 1973 Ford Carousel, is also in charge of getting this into production. The 1984 Plymouth Voyager or Dodge Caravan.
Right, because they're still both two boxes. The largest difference, honestly, is there's an extra row of window panes on the carousel.
I gotta say, I kind of like the window design of the carousel better. It looks almost like a scaled down full size van on top.
Yeah, it does.
Versus the caravan and Plymouth Voyager, because those are more flat, like almost like plate glass pieces that were put in, almost like from a house or something.
Yeah,
that's what it looks like. But the other ones were more styled like an old station wagon. Maybe the roof line is a lot more like a station wagon or full size van than the caravan. But very, very interesting comparison to draw between the two. And there's probably a ton of stuff we can say about these vans, right?
Yes.
I mean, a lot of firsts, of course.
Sure.
Which I'm hesitant to bring up, the first always, but there are all kinds of stuff. I know you've got some other information to throw in besides the first, though. So,
So at the same time, I think this is a great case study of how these seemingly rival companies can find themselves marching in lockstep sometimes. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to hear what you think, folks. So around the same time Chrysler is going like gangbusters with the Voyager, Ford, of all people, it's like, oh, yeah, we've also been doing that, which must have been hilarious to Lee Iacocca.
Yeah.
And
well, they do this all the time. They revamp an old idea.
Right. So in 84, they revealed the Ford Aerostar.
Yeah.
And it was a prototype of an intended vehicle. In 85, it actually comes out and they start selling it.
So it's just that Chrysler beat them by a year, really. I mean, it's kind of like a Me Too thing, we're doing this as well.
But that's an important year. And that's the other question, you have to ask yourself, is it better to be first or is it better to be second? You know what I mean? Like, if you, I was going to say, is it better to be first or is it better to be best? Mm-hmm.
The truth is, these early products, they weren't, I wouldn't call either one of them best.
I don't think you can.
I mean, well, maybe, but that's looking through a filter of you know, 30 years.
Yeah.
There are 34 years now, right?
Is
that right?
The benefit of hindsight.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we do. And, but at the time, you know, it was very functional, very, desired. It was a desired product in the marketplace. People wanted exactly what they were giving them. And cause again, sales numbers were huge. And, mm-hmm. and it doesn't, you know, take a genius to figure out that, you know, with all these firsts, these industry firsts, you know, Caravan and Voyager and Town and Country and all those, you know, the minivans from Chrysler and Plymouth, they just seem to kind of lead the market in a lot of ways for a lot of years. I mean, going right sure. up through, right through present day, really. They still do. And not saying that they're first in everything, but I'm looking at a list of first, minivan firsts.
Yeah. So what do you got?
Particular in that group, but I mean, I can't read them all. There's no way. So I'll hit a couple here and the year that it happened. But back in 1988, they pioneered the way with, turbocharged gas engines. There was also, this is another car that we haven't talked about. One that, maybe a lot of people haven't heard about this vehicle, but it's a Renault eSpace. And I hope I'm not saying that incorrectly. I hope it's not eSpace, but I think it's eSpace. In 1984, they also released a vehicle, you know, badged Renault. The thing is, that came along with the Chrysler UK company working with another manufacturer called Matra, M-A-T-R-A. And Matra, which went defunct in about 2003, played a key role in this whole development as well. But they shared design. So there's no surprise that, you know, this Renault came out right around the same time when the Chrysler came out here in the United States. Matra was a maker of automobiles, bicycles, aeronautics, weaponry, that kind of thing. They did a lot of different things.
Yeah.
But again, Matra was critical in or played a key role in the Renault eSpace development. And I think that the turbo diesel was also used to the end of 1984 in that Renault eSpace anyways. But again, early on. So the turbocharged gas engine is 1998. There was an electric minivan option called the Epic in 1995. All the way back in 1995, they had an electric minivan.
Hmm.
All-wheel drive in 1991. I'm skipping around here a little bit. But bucket seats in both the front – both in the first two rows in 1991. So that was something new. Man, they had all kinds of California ultra low emission vehicle certification back in 1997 or for 1997 back in 1994. So 3 years ahead of time. They had passenger side airbags. I guess they were seamless and that was the big thing then. So 1996, just all kinds of, oh, here's one. Adjustable cup holders, 1996. That's a big deal.
Yeah.
Well, isn't this one of the vans? I got to say that the Chrysler vans, the minivans.
Yeah.
I think these were one of the ones that would just, it seemed like every year they were saying they're up in the number of cup holders.
Yeah.
So you remember there was like almost like a battle going on for a while, a cup holder battle where they'd say we have 16 cup holders in the Chrysler Town and Country.
It got bananas because there were more cup holders than there were available seats.
Yeah. And I mean, we're talking like two cup holders per seat, you know, at some point in a lot of these minivans. So,
like how what are your kids drinking?
It got a little bit out of control. I mean, they had you know, mid cabin upper level comfort controls in 1996. There's a list of probably 45 different things here. I mean, all wheel drive, you know, that kind of stuff.
Interesting. Which a lot of people might not expect.
Yeah, interesting. All wheel drive in 91. I think I mentioned that one already.
Yeah.
But lots of different things. And passenger side airbags that were standard. I don't think that happened until 1994. Believe it or not. So 10 years after it was developed, it's along the way, Chrysler has played a huge role in minivan history. That's
right.
All I'm saying. But, you know, a lot of other manufacturers, Toyota, Honda, you know, of course, other makers across the pond have across with, you know, lots of minivan designs and ideas. And there have been variations of these and crossovers. And you said you've got more information on the 84s. Is that right?
Well, one thing that I think is really important here is with just the highlights of the first that you pulled here, you can see how these are also already moving toward the idea of comfort over performance, which inevitably leads to a luxurious ride. Like, look, man, I'm the first to say it. A lot of those, like 2017, 2018 minivans, mm-hmm. have you been in one?
Oh, yeah.
They're nice.
Oh, they're really nice.
It's like your rich friend's house.
Yeah. They are. I've actually got a lot to say about the modern minivans. I mean,
yeah, we should talk about it.
Well, how about we push that a couple minutes?
All right.
To the end of this episode, because okay. I want your opinion on some and when's the most recent time you've been on a minivan,
all right.
Can I mention one more thing about unless you had other things to
cover. No, lay it on me.
One more thing that I found really interesting about Chrysler minivans. So you got to imagine that there was a first car that came off the assembly line, right? There had to have been a very first minivan, and it turns out that very first minivan was one that they used in the Windsor assembly plant as kind of a vehicle in the shop. They used it to, drag parts around and people, and it is a transport vehicle. So it got pretty abused, pretty beat up, along the way. And someone there at the factory coerce somebody or talk somebody into the idea that this is historically important. It's a minivan. I know it's a minivan, but it's the first. We need to do something with it. And they decided that they were going to restore it.
That's cool.
They restored the first minivan. I think that's really cool too. So they restored the very first minivan and it was put on display at the Walter P. Chrysler Museum, which no longer exists. I mean, I think it's out of the building's still there. It's something different now, in Auburn Hills. But it was a tan Plymouth Voyager. With, I think it even had wood grain on the side, so just exactly as you would imagine. But they fully restored it. Now, this is the interesting part, Ben.
Yeah.
I said it was a Plymouth Voyager, right? Somewhere along the way, during restoration, that Plymouth Voyager turned into a Dodge Caravan. Whoever restored it rebadged it. So you gotta remember, now Plymouth went defunct in the year of 2001,
yeah.
I believe mid-June or mid-year 2001. So somebody made the decision when they were restoring this, and I don't know if this is to avoid some uncomfortable, conversations at the museum, as to why, you don't make the Plymouth brand anymore. I'm guessing that's it, but they changed it over by, just making simple changes like badges and the grill and the wheel covers and, Dodge trim is what they added really to this Plymouth Voyager. So how interesting is that? It was like rewriting history, I guess. So when you see that first minivan, wherever it is now, I don't know who owns it or, where it's being held, but, know that that was originally a Plymouth Voyager from 1984 and not a Dodge Caravan.
It's so weird.
Yeah, and I think there's one at the Smithsonian. I don't know if that's that may be the first one. Maybe they donated it to the Smithsonian.
A case of mistaken identity.
But there is an early 1984 minivan, a Chrysler minivan of some sort. I don't know if that's the one.
Yeah.
But it's in the Smithsonian, the automation or the transportation museum.
Somebody should write them a letter. They don't know?
Somebody knows. I mean, I found the story somewhere. It was
on
the Alpar site if you want to look it up.
Something tells me the curators of the Smithsonian know what's in their exhibit.
I think they have a pretty good idea, I would think. So, Ben, okay, so unless you have other material on the Chrysler minivans or particularly that era of minivan, I'd like to kind of move on to the modern era. And just in brief, really, what was the last time you were in a minivan? And how recent do you think? I mean, just ballpark, what model year it was. Ballpark.
Last time I was in a minivan.
Mm-hmm.
Last time I was in a minivan, I was actually taking a Lyft, which is, the competitor to Uber, L-Y-F-T. And it was really weird. Because the guy who was driving and the guy who owned the vehicle, this was a 90s. It was an older model.
Oh, wow.
This was late last year, I want to say. Maybe
about a year ago. Recent, but an older vehicle.
Yeah, recent, but an older vehicle. Mm-hmm. And this joker had taken out, some of the seating. So, there was just if everyone can imagine this with me, there was the driver's seat, the shotgun seat, and then the back row.
Oh, way in the back by the window?
Yeah, and then it was just empty space. And it smelled like incense in there, and I had hopped in, but my car, of course, was in the shop. And usually I try to be very complimentary. If I'm hitching a ride with somebody, unless their car is a real POS, then I'm gonna say oh, this is a cool car. And, if they're into cars, we can talk about something, right? Mm-hmm. Oh, what's, I met somebody who's driving a Honda Pilot. I had never been in one. And, you know, honestly, the Honda Odyssey, I think, has outsold the Honda Pilot mm-hmm. by a pretty significant margin several times. Yeah. So I was interested to see why that guy would. But this dude in this, I want to say maybe it was a Town and Country.
Okay.
This thing was so weird that I was, I didn't know what to say. And so instead of a question, I sort of ended up saying something lame like, you got a lot of room back here.
A lot of leg room in this
I don't
thing.
Know what it was for. Yeah.
Like the old Checker cabs. That
and
had,
they
you
put
know,
carpet down on it too.
Oh, really?
Not like, you know, not like fuzzy house carpet, but like the kind of like upholstery stuff you have on a car.
Like a mat.
Like a mat.
Yeah,
like
okay.
a big mat.
I got it.
And I totally didn't understand that. But the most...
Well, it sounds like kind of a bad experience, really.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not a fair evaluation of it, because that's an unusual situation.
Right. And he was a nice guy.
Yeah.
By the way.
Sure.
Just had some very interesting choices in his van life. the more, I think, one of the more interesting experiences I had, at least for longtime listeners, was several years before that. How long we've been at this current office for about, what, two and a half years
yeah,
now?
Yeah. Yeah. I think
yeah. So.
So
we used to, you probably heard it, folks, on one of our earlier shows. Scott and I used to work in an office that was located in a downtown area of Atlanta called Buckhead. And there was an underground parking deck where everybody would have to park. Scott, you and I typically parked on the bottom so that nobody would mess up our cars.
Yeah, ding the cars.
Ding the cars. Mm-hmm. And one day, it was later, and I was walking through the parking deck, and I see I'll just let the badger out of the bag. Mm-hmm. See this gold Honda Odyssey rolling up, and I'm on foot. So I don't really have any beef with it at this point. I'm just going to keep walking, play it cool.
Sure.
Try to be anonymous.
Yeah, avoid eye contact.
Avoid eye contact. Yes, sir. Actually, I was doing that, like in Wayne's World where they see the ex-girlfriend. but I hear the telltale of a flat tire, and I look, and there's like this elderly lady driving this vehicle.
Yeah.
And she's about to head out to some of the worst traffic in the city. It's like a run over, and I stop, and I think you have heard this story, but not many people have.
Yeah.
And I stop, and I'm like waving her down. And at first I think she's not going to stop. And then I think, oh my God, it's true. I'm going to die at the hands of a Honda Odyssey driver. But she does stop. She's obviously a little irritated. She's trying to get home. And so your tire is flat. And she's like, do you think I can make it home? I said, no, it is not soft. It is flat.
Yeah.
And, do you have a spare tire? And she says it's somewhere. And so I say, okay, is it somewhere in the back? Like I've resigned the fact that I'm going to have to help this lady.
Yeah. Underneath possibly.
It is underneath okay, yeah. this compartment. I yeah. find it. And it was my first time in a Honda Odyssey, and I was thinking, you know what? On the inside, it's not that bad.
Yeah.
However, she did get on my bad side when I was looking for it, and she didn't have the jack and the jack and stuff where it was supposed to be.
Oh, the tools weren't there.
Right. Well, they were somewhere else.
Oh,
I found them.
Gotcha.
They were in a plastic bag in the back.
Okay.
But she asked me, Scott, I know I'm rambling here, but this was a turning
That's right.
point
it's
for
like,
me.
It's like therapy for you.
Kind of, because she said, how long do you think this is going to take?
Oh my gosh.
As I was 8 minutes in to finding a tire that she had no idea existed.
In your yard doing a good deed.
And I stopped, yeah. I stopped talking to her at that point.
Yeah.
Other than procedural questions.
Mm.
Where's your jack? What? There is a set of there are things that come with your tire
yeah.
that I need to lift up your van and change the tire for you. It's like I don't know where the car stuff is. And
oh boy.
Yeah, so I found it anyway, changed the tire. I understand nobody's expecting a flat tire. It's never a great time.
But you did get a glimpse inside of a new minivan then.
And it was nice.
It was really nice.
It was really nice.
And the truth is, you probably didn't get to really see all the features. You didn't get to see that, you know, Honda Odysseys have a built-in vacuum, which is actually a really nice feature.
No, I had no idea. I was being harassed and harangued.
You know, they've got navigation system. They've got, you know, all the modern features. They're quite luxurious inside. Not just the Odyssey, mm-hmm. but all minivans now. They've blurred the lines between mm-hmm. luxury and, I guess, utility.
And what, pardon my rant. You're right, sure. Scott. It did turn into a rant.
That's all right.
What's the last time you were in a minivan?
I rented one recently. Like when we went to Detroit a couple of, I guess it'd be several months ago now.
Yeah.
Almost a year, really.
What'd you get?
We got a Chrysler Town & Country or a Dodge Caravan. I can't remember which one it was, but it was a Chrysler product.
Yeah.
Just loaded with really nice stuff. I mean, it had, you know, all the modern bells and whistles that you would expect.
Rear view camera.
Yeah, more technology than you could ever use, really, mm-hmm. in, you know, a rental car that, you know, you're just borrowing for a weekend or whatever it was, or 3 or 4 days. So nice, in fact, and this is funny, my kid, you know what kind of cars my wife and I drive, right?
Right.
I have a 2012 Volkswagen CC. Mm-hmm. It's not bad. It's not brand new or anything. My wife has a 2015 Jeep Renegade. Not bad. It's all right. I have some grapes.
I would say the CC is a really good car, actually.
I like it, right? It's a decent looking ride. It has a decent ride to it. It's a neat car. My kid gets in this minivan. She's 15 now, so maybe this explains some of it, the attitude. But she says, wow, this is really nice. You know, she's in the back seat, and she says, compared to this, it's like you and Mom drive hobo cars. Now, have you ever heard anybody say the term hobo cars? Can you believe that? That's her opinion of our cars, or that they're hobo cars.
You have a hobo car?
I thought that was so funny that here's what I did. I texted myself just these two words, hobo cars. At the time, because I knew I would never remember the term or the phrase that she used. It's such an unusual term. Oh, anyway, man. So quite a slam on our vehicles, but she was really impressed with the minivan, which I didn't expect out of a 15-year-old. You'd think that would be an uncool car.
Right.
However, it's just, again, loaded with luxury items.
Built-in entertainment system.
And I'll tell you, like, driving it around town, it's nice. I wouldn't want to own one personally just because of the size and the type of vehicle it is. I just am not a fan of that. But It really has all the features that you would want in anything that size, and it's comfortable mm-hmm. to take a long road trip in that thing. I bet it would be very comfortable. I remember even back in the mid-1990s renting those in Florida, you know, like in the Orlando area for video production or something. You know, you have a lot of gear to carry. It was the best option, really, because you could carry people and gear. And of course, it smelled moldy and mildewy, like every rental car in Orlando, Florida does, because of the humidity there. Mm-hmm. But it was really nice. They were solid vehicles even back then, and you know, just they had everything you need. They're comfortable, and even though you hated to admit it, you know, when I was a 24-year-old at the time, you know, when I was renting these, it was a nice vehicle. I mean, I wouldn't want to buy one. But to rent one and just to drive it around, and it was very comfortable. It had everything you'd want. It was actually a decent car, a decent vehicle.
So we have our anecdotal experience.
Yeah.
We may have to go back and edit some of mine, but, we do have to ask about the future. You know, is the rise of minivans, which began in the 80s, is it going to continue? Well, it seems that sales have sharply declined as of April of this year. And some of the questions that we hear about, you know, here regarding this situation, they all kind of orbit some of the age old questions you hear about, automotive products. You know, in the New York Times, it's really interesting, in the 80s when minivans first came out, the New York Times.
Supposedly,
right. When they were called minivans, first modern minivans.
All right.
Take all the caveats from this whole episode and just pretend I said them all again.
Sorry, Ben.
No, it's a great point. I'm glad you made it.
Okay.
But the New York Times was ranting and raving, and they were all Twitter-pated about it, and they were saying Chrysler's invented this entirely new market for vehicles, where, of course, other people would say, oh, the days of the station wagon are numbered. And now we have to ask ourselves, are minivans transforming? Is it that the people who would have normally purchased a minivan, 10, 15 years ago? Are they going to be buying crossovers? Are they going to be buying SUVs, compact SUVs, for instance?
Yeah. I think that's true.
I think that's the direction that things are headed in, but also it's not a ding on the minivans. I mean, if they're meant to be family cars, right, then it seems like their emphasis on luxury and comfort is paying off. Look, man, do you feel like a sucker holding a cup in your lap now?
Yeah, that's right. You know, here's the thing with minivans, and we didn't really state this, I guess, but they have plenty of room to include just about every luxury feature you want as well.
That's a really good point.
They're big. So, like, there's not a lot of the space concerns that you would find in a smaller sedan or in a sports car or even, I guess luxury cars have space for stuff like this too, but minivans have, I wouldn't say unlimited space, but they've got a lot more space for engineers to kind of play with and toy with and add the latest technology, the latest features, the latest, bells and whistles. And I think that they're taking advantage of that and they're just loading them up with stuff. And I'm sure they're expensive. I don't know what the average minivan costs now, but I bet it's up there. I bet it's expensive. And probably with good reason with all the stuff that they fill them up with.
And minivans are probably very great, probably fantastic customizable vehicles. Mm-hmm. If you are a business owner who needs to be mobile, right? Yeah. You see a lot of minivans being, converted into work vans for, electricians, for instance, plumbers even.
Yeah, but if they can't get away with a full size, like a Sprinter van or something like that. You know?
Here's another thing that gets me. These then would, in theory, be ideal vehicles for, like, secret agents. Like James Bond is showing off when he's Aston Martins.
Yeah, yeah. You don't need that sports car.
Also, he would never drive a Chrysler.
No, probably not.
Like Queen would put a hit on him or something. but I guess we are kind of drawing to a close here, you have some more stuff.
Well, I have a question. I guess I wonder if minivans have seen kind of their better days. You know, if they're a thing of the past now, and not that station wagons ever went away, but I wonder if it's a similar thing that they're going to start to wane, and they have already started to wane in popularity.
Yeah,
is it going to be more of just like the kind of the oddball production vehicle that they still make? You know, at Honda or Toyota or Chrysler or wherever, or are they going to remain, you know, in the marketplace, still fairly prominent on the dealer lots? Are they gonna just go away? Are station wagons coming back? Are crossovers going to take over?
Right.
And if so, how long will crossovers have before something new comes about?
And will we see a divergence in buying trends across the world?
But I think a lot of minivan owners will say that you're not going to pry that minivan out of my cold, dead hands.
You're
going to have to pry it out of my cold, dead hands because they love them. Once they're in them, I think you find that you really like them. You really appreciate everything that they offer. Mm. A lot like, you know, the Pontiac Aztec or something like that, where a lot of people make fun of it or laugh at it. But when you're inside one, if you drive one, they claim they sell themselves. I mean, at the time they did, that people loved them once they were inside them and drove them, realized the possibility of that vehicle, but they were so ugly on the outside, according to most people.
Not for everyone.
Yeah. And I guess that's the same thing with minivan. It has a stigma attached to it. And the stigma is that, you know, you're a middle-aged family man or a family woman, I guess, and you are kind of saddled with lots of responsibilities and tasks and things that you have to do, you know, shuttling the kids to soccer games or hockey games or whatever. Mm-hmm. And it's not really the car that you want to drive. It's the car you have to drive.
I don't know, man. When I was I'm showing my age now, but when I was in high school, when we all started driving, a kitted out 70s looking, like a minivan that looked like a 70s customized full size van. Shag carpet, got some art on the back window.
You get like an old Chevy Astro van or something.
Yeah, those would be like the dream. but it is a great question, and stigma does have a profound and significant effect on buying trends. I would like to add just one more question completely unrelated to our show.
Okay.
Or completely unrelated to this episode. And this is for all you out there, ladies and gentlemen. Please let us know what you think of minivans, of your experience driving one or your experience being on the road with minivan drivers, right? Positive, negative. let us know.
Sure.
Let us know if you think the minivan is, as Scott asked, is it a temporary dip? Is it going to
– Is it on its way out?
Is it on its way out? And then also answer this question for me. I was thinking about this earlier this week. So I drove into work this few days ago. No parking spaces in the usual place where we park. The reason there are no parking spaces, or the reason there's not a parking space for me or anybody else who comes, is because there is a Ferrari that is double parked.
Hmm.
And I think you may have seen this Ferrari before.
I do know that one, yeah.
Yeah. So here's the question. Are there ever circumstances where it is right to double park your car?
Okay. We've talked about our parking structure many times, so the pillar situation.
Right.
There's pillars, it seems like every 10 feet.
Oh, I know you're good. I knew you were going to defend this guy.
So I mean, you know what? I normally wouldn't, but man.
It's also a Ferrari.
It's a Ferrari. It's a 458.
Yeah.
And very nice. And you know how tight our parking area is.
Yeah.
And it's extremely tight. And
yeah.
We've griped about it enough times that people already know this. But in this one particular case, I would say I can understand this. And really, occupying two spaces in this building is like occupying one space in a reasonable parking lot. A reasonable one.
I am surprised. You're usually like a lawful good type personality.
Honestly, I mean, they park on the extreme highest floor, and
yeah.
there's less congestion up there. So oftentimes they're open spots where in other floors they're not open spots at all. And I guess on this day, the particular day that you came, there were no open parking spots. But I do have to defend this this one instance.
I'm still on the fence about it because the thing is, I was PO'd when I was walking into the office, and I thought, you know, why don't you just put your car somewhere else? It's already a bad decision to take this work of art here.
Well, it's covered, and it's
covered. It's away
secure.
From the elements.
It's
relatively.
It's a badged garage, and it's
yeah.
only employees. It's something. It's someplace you can
employees and residents.
It's someplace you can trust. Right?
Right.
It's not like
no
it's a public parking lot. Now, in a
it.
Public parking lot, my opinion on this would be, you know, if somebody in an exotic that parks in either a handicapped spot or takes a spot up close and takes two spots.
I don't think you should
I would
park
say,
in a handicapped spot.
Never. If you don't have the appropriate credentials and the need.
Yeah.
But to take up two spots close up in a public parking area,
yeah.
that's uncalled for. You just go to the back of the lot and take up two spots if you want to. That should be fine. I mean, no one's being hurt in that situation.
Well, as my day was going, I was thinking, you know, the sentence that kept surfacing in my head was, but it's a Ferrari. So I'm on the fence. Scott is defending him. We want to hear from you. Under what circumstances is it okay to double park your car, right? I think that's a good way to phrase it.
And I bet a lot of people have a one-word response. Never.
Well, I bet a lot of people will have never ...
Yeah.
Except when.
Now, see, that's exactly how you and I feel, right?
Like if you have a Bugatti and you're in a really tight parking situation.
I guess. Or you plan your day so you never have to park it. Like, you know, you just take it home.
Right.
And you drive it around and then you bring it back home again. You never park it anywhere.
Or if you are in a pay parking lot and you just buy two spots. See, I think that's like airplane rules then.
You buy two spots?
If you buy two spots.
Well, paid parking, that's a different ballgame.
See, there are cases. Okay, this is quickly turning into a different episode.
That's
but
right.
We do hope you enjoyed the minivan episode. So thank you to Weston B., S. Wirtz, and Dano for writing in. Thanks to everybody else who wrote in and suggested this on Facebook or Twitter or emailed us. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter. We are CarStuff HSW. You can find our Woody episode, which still holds up. I checked back in on it, along with every other episode we've ever done at our website, carstuffshow.com. It's free.
Yeah. Oh, and thanks for hanging in there for this 3-hour episode.
Oh, yeah.
Isn't it about 3 hours?
I guess we did go a little bit long.
On minivans, it's good, though, right? I mean, I think we've had some fun.
Well, maybe this will be the director's cut, and then we'll go.
I would bet that this was not the minivan episode a lot of people anticipated when they first clicked on that link.
I hope it wasn't.
I feel the same way.
and let us know about that too. You can write to us with any feedback about your personal experience with minivans, whether you are a critic or a supporter.
Yeah, fur it or again it.
Fur it or again it, as we like to say. And if you have suggestions for a topic you think we should cover in the future, we'd love to hear from you. We are
CarStuff@HowStuffWorks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@HowStuffWorks.com.